from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Even with the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, the global community pledged to keep the planet from warming by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. But a new report from the International Panel on Climate Change finds that it may be so much harder than previously thought to reach that goal. Nothing less than a, quote, rapid and far-reaching transformation of human civilization is required, the report finds. Just last month, U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres foreshadowed the IPCC's warning.
We have reached a pivotal moment. If we do not change course in the next 2 years, we risk runaway climate change.
This hour on Point, that new climate report and humanity's urgent new deadline. And you can join us. What do you make of the IPCC's report? Scientists are saying rapid changes on a civilizational scale are needed. Is that even possible, especially now that the United States government has stepped away from the Paris Agreement? What do you want to hear from the White House, from the EPA after this report? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me first today from Washington is Chris Mooney. He covers climate change, energy, and the environment for The Washington Post, and we have links to his recent reporting at onpointradio.org. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So first of all, give us some of the top line details of what the scientists in this IPCC report are saying. Are they saying that 1.5 degrees is not a reasonable goal anymore?
Well, they very carefully do not take a stand on that question, but they do clearly show that it will be extremely difficult. And in order to do it, essentially, you have to do something that humanity hasn't done before, which is radically change major systems, how we get energy, how we get food, how we get around transportation, how we build our cities. So they, once they've described the magnitude of what's required, it's reasonable to ask whether it can be done.
Okay. So the Paris Climate Agreement that of holding warming to 1.5 degrees over pre-industrial levels was considered to be pretty ambitious to begin with. So, I mean, what are scientists saying that we would need to – well, let me first ask you, are scientists saying that current practices and current plans to meet that goal are not enough?
Unequivocally, they're saying that. So they're saying that current promises made by countries, which they made as part of the Paris Agreement process, will give us 3 degrees Celsius, so over 5 degrees Fahrenheit of warming by the end of the century. Then they prepared this report that we're now discussing, saying what would have to be done in order to just limit it to 1.5, which is about 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. And there they're saying basically incredibly radical fast actions. Just to give you some numbers, the world currently emits about 40 billion plus tons of carbon dioxide gas per year. That would have to be cut almost in half by 2030, so just 12 years. So you do the math. It has to be over a billion tons of cuts per year. Then you look at the countries of the world. That's more than almost every country emits every year. There's only about five that emit more than that. So you're talking about taking the emissions of a country, a large emitting country, away annually.
Okay. So what are the scientists saying the consequences may be if we, even in best case scenario, continue along the path that we are on now?
Sure. One of the other aspects of this report is that it reflects that research has gotten increasingly good about near-term climate change and what it will actually look like. We used to study long-term climate change, you know, far out 2100, and then they could say, oh, if you have 7 degrees of warming, then you'll have huge amounts of sea level rise, et cetera. Now they can say, oh, just another half a degree, what does it look like? And they've honed in on some pretty serious impacts even at that level. And that's partly because we're starting to see them already. Some of the most striking things in the report when it comes to impacts include coral reefs, where we've already seen really, really major tragic coral death at the Great Barrier Reef and a number of other reefs. What they're saying is that at 1.5C, coral reefs will still be around, but they already will have retreated greatly, something like 70 to 90%. And that's kind of staggering for this ecosystem that's sort of fundamental to the tropics. Another thing that they say that is extremely striking is that at 1.5 or 2, and they don't really know for sure, but you could have what scientists call instabilities kick in Greenland or Antarctica, and those instabilities, as they put it, could unleash many feet of sea level rise.
I'm seeing here that there are predictions that if we pass that 1.5 degrees of warming, what, 10 million more people permanently exposed to high levels of flooding or inundation, hundreds of millions to climate-related risks, poverty, disease. So it's not just sort of ecosystem level. I mean, ecosystem is huge, but environmental level issues, it's also impact on humanity itself.
Right. So with each degree or half a degree that you warm the planet, one of the most easily predicted things is that you will have more heat extremes. And you know, eventually you get to a point where what it seemed like an extremely hot day is sort of normal, and then the extremely hot days are much beyond that. And so with 1.5C, we're at 1 now, by the way. We should underscore that it's 1.5C is quite close. You would definitely get worsening heat waves. You get worsening weather extremes of a large variety of types. They will hit different regions differently. Some places might actually get sort of more of a dry extreme, which can be very damaging, sort of drought conditions. Other places might get too much water and rainfall. And so it's going to vary, but it just gets more intense as the temperature increases.
Okay. Chris Mooney, stand by here for just a second. I want to play a quick bit of tape. This is from just yesterday. IPCC Chairman Ho-Sung Lee announced the committee's new findings at a press conference in South Korea.
Limiting warming to 1.5 degrees is not impossible, but will require unprecedented transitions in all aspects of society. There are clear benefits to keep warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius compared to 2 degrees or higher. Every bit of warming matters.
That's IPCC Chairman Ho-Sung Lee just yesterday. Chris, hang on here for a second, because I want to bring in Drew Schindel. He's a professor of climate scientists at Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment. He was an author of, well, one of the authors on yesterday's report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and a former scientist at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. And Drew Schindel joins us from Durham, North Carolina. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Meghna.
Hi. So I want to explore in greater detail with you some of the consequences and proposed solutions that the IPCC report put out. But can we just take a step back here for a second and really kind of get a detailed understanding of what we mean by 1 degree of warming, 1.5 degrees Celsius warming, 2 degrees? Because, I mean, at first brush, when you just hear those numbers, they sound, you know, I wouldn't blame people for thinking they sound relatively small. But we're talking massive amounts of heat. So when we say 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think not only do people think they're small, but often they think that sounds kind of pleasant, you know, an extra degree warming. It's why a lot of people move south to get away from the cold. So unfortunately, what comes along with that global average temperature is substantially greater temperature change over almost all the land areas of the world, and especially high mountain areas and the polar regions. And that leads to melting of the ice. It leads to melting of glaciers, land ice, sea ice, and the ice sheets in both polar regions, which leads to substantial amounts of sea level rise. And you get flooding all along the coasts, all the way around the world. You also get what Chris was talking about before. You get heat extremes that are what used to be something like the extreme heat wave that hit Europe in 2003 was maybe a 1-in-100-year event. And that becomes as often as every other year in just a few decades down the line when you get to 1.5 or 2 degrees. So you get wildfires, droughts, stronger hurricanes, all these things that we shouldn't be lulled into complacency by thinking, oh, it's just a small number when it comes to global average.
So as we see temperatures rising in various places, we also see sort of climate-linked effects, as you're talking about, including, I'm thinking, you know, mosquito-borne diseases, malaria, dengue fever, that kind of thing that the mosquitoes do well in warmer environments. So we could see, I mean, how much of a spread could we see of diseases like that?
Well, we could see a fair amount. You know, that's a very complex process. Yeah. Because the mosquitoes also like standing water to breed in. It's not simply a function of temperature, and rainfall goes up some places and down others. You tend to have more extremes, though. You have downpours and you have droughts. So when you have a downpour, you can have more breeding areas and more mosquitoes go to high latitudes. But the other, you know, as far as diseases, one of the most difficult or the most impactful health outcomes, they're the heat extremes, which can cause a lot of people to go to the hospital or even die from heat exposure. And there's crop failures, which lead to malnutrition and even undernutrition or stunting or death, especially in the tropics where there's not always enough food to go around.
Okay. Now, Drew Schindel, the IPCC was created by the UN Environment Program in 1988. And I believe this is the sixth report since the IPCC's creation. This one seems so much more dire than ones we've read before. I mean, what has changed?
Well, what's changed is the world around us. Unfortunately, that's a large part of it is, you know, we've long since run these computer models and we try to project to our best ability what might happen in the future. And people say, well, you know, it's just a model. It might be wrong. Unfortunately, it turns out that for the most part, the models have been, when they've been wrong, it's been in the sense of being too conservative. And we've waited so long that we're seeing these events unfold around us. And so, as Chris mentioned, you know, we know a lot about what happens when we warm by an extra half a degree, because in the last 40 years or so, we have warmed by half a degree. And we've seen hurricanes hold more water. We've seen coastal areas get flooded. We've seen the occurrence of heat extremes go up. So we're not just relying on these models. We're actually seeing that the models have, if anything, been kind of too conservative. And we're now reaching areas of dangerous and damaging impacts more quickly than we realized we would back in the 80s and 90s.
Well, Drew Schindel and Chris Mooney, stand by for just a second. We have to take a quick break. We are talking about the IPCC's new dire warnings about climate change. Do you think civilizational change is something we can accomplish by the time we need to? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the IPCC's latest report released just yesterday about the consequences of global climate change. It's a very dire new report, and it's based on more than 6,000 cited studies written by 91 authors from 40 different countries, and saying that if we continue on the path that we are now globally, that the devastation that climate change could cause would change human civilization permanently. I'm joined today by Chris Mooney. He covers climate change, energy, and the environment for The Washington Post. Drew Schindel also joins us. He's professor of climate sciences at Duke University and was one of the authors on yesterday's report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And Chris and Drew, I just want to play us a little bit of tape here. This is Jim Ski, scientist and lead author of the IPCC report. And he said that we need to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and lots of it, but warning that doing so will also have some consequences.
To limit warming to 1.5 degrees C, we would need to start taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere during the 21st century. The methods for doing this include planting trees, bioenergy combined with carbon capture and storage, changed land management, as well as some novel approaches that are very early stages of development. However, carbon dioxide removal on a large scale could have implications for food security, for ecosystems, and for biodiversity.
That's Jim Ski, scientist and lead author of the IPCC report. Chris Mooney, it's the last part. I mean, we'll talk about these negative inputs as Ski talks about there. But it's this. It's when he said that removal on a large scale of carbon dioxide could have implications for food security and things like that. What is he talking about?
What he's talking about is this is a key part of the report. Not only does it say that emissions have to be cut at an extremely rapid pace, such that, as I said before, you have to remove the emissions of a major economy annually, but on top of that, you have to create an entire new industry that pulls carbon dioxide out of the air. And this doesn't exist now, so people have been trying to imagine it in studies and in climate models. And one of the ways in which they've imagined it involves planting huge, essentially plantations of trees or crops and using those for energy, but making sure that you capture the emissions that are released when they're burned and put those in the ground so that you're sucking carbon dioxide out of the air into the plants and then pulling it into the ground and getting energy along the way. This is what he referred to as bioenergy combined with carbon capture and storage. But there's this huge problem, which is that you need an enormous area of land to do this, and land has other uses like growing food. So what they're saying is that we might need so much land to pull carbon out of the air that it might compete with the need to feed the world's growing population.
Drew Schindel, that sounds like a very sobering zero-sum game.
Yeah, you know, I think that taking the risk that we can emit more carbon now and we will make up for it later by pulling it out of the air is akin to, you know, buying a new house on a credit card and hoping that eventually you'll get a better job and be able to pay for it. You know, this is an enormous gamble with the future of our whole planet. And I think, you know, it turning over a large portion of our arable land to grow crops to burn them and to use a large portion of our water to grow those crops and our fertilizer has enormous implications for biodiversity and ability to feed the planet. And so if we cut our emissions much more rapidly, and we do have scenarios that do this in the report, we do not need to rely on this kind of technological carbon removal. You can get away with only planting trees, the kind of carbon removal that we already know about and is relatively benign. But that requires the most aggressive cuts in carbon of any of the scenarios we explored.
But just to be clear, I mean, as Chris was saying, would some of that tree planting globally be taking place on arable land that would otherwise be needed for, you know, to feed the extra 2 billion people that we expect to be added to the world's population in the next several decades?
That would generally be restoring abandoned lands or marginal lands.
Okay.
And so we could, if we keep the reliance on these negative emissions at its lowest possible levels, which you can only do, of course, by cutting carbon aggressively right away, then we can get away without really compromising most of our arable land.
Okay. I want to get to the emissions cutting scenario, the aggressive emissions cutting scenarios that you're talking about, that you hinted at there in just a second. But we do have a lot of callers who want to join us, and obviously this is an issue that affects us all. So let me just get to them. Amara is calling from East Lansing, Michigan. You're on the air.
Hi, Magna. My question is, when will the people that are profiting from the destruction of the environment, like oil barons or whatnot, when will they be held accountable? Like, the conversation's very scary, but often I never hear anyone speak of who makes the money off all this.
And so, when you say accountability, what are you asking for?
Taxes or something to fund programs to do these sorts of things, these actions that need to be taken.
So you like carbon taxes or income taxes? I'm just trying to get a sense of what you're hoping for.
I'm thinking income taxes or something, or a tax on profit if it's people make billions off of oil.
Okay. Chris Mooney, Amara, first of all, thank you for your call. And Chris Mooney, do you have a response for her?
Well, I don't know. I would put it a little differently. I mean, this is climate change is the consequence of industrial civilization. It's the consequence of all of us deciding to adopt the technologies that we created that make our lives better, driving, you know, heating your home, cooling your home, and many, many other things, eating food that comes from very far away. And we often forget that every one of those things has this side effect, which is that it takes energy. And to get that energy, we've mostly burned fossil fuels. So the way that we live and the scale at which we are using energy is really what's at stake here. So yes, there's companies that sell energy. At this point, a lot of them are actually fully accepting of the science and trying to find ways to do it differently.
Drew Schindel, pick up on that thought, because I mean, I think Chris is exactly right. This is an indictment of modern civilization. And so if that's the very thing that we're saying needs to be changed rapidly, how is that possible?
Well, there is an indictment in some sense of people's choices and people consuming too much red meat and, you know, people using more energy than they need. But I believe that this really is also an indictment of some of the fossil fuel companies and automotive companies and those who have been pushing aggressively and recently succeeding in getting regulations rolled back. And so you take something like release of methane from the natural gas industry, and this was a measure that would nearly pay for itself because methane is the main component of natural gas. They would capture more of their own product, and they said it would cost them a little bit of money, so they got the Trump administration to push that regulation back. It would almost pay for itself without even counting for the environmental cost. So what's happening in reality is that we all pick up these costs, you know, more than $100 billion a year in disaster relief expenditures. Everybody's health care premiums go up when people suffer from heat waves and suffer from air pollution. And so these companies really are profiting by imposing a hidden tax on every other part of American business and American consumers. And I think until we do change that, like something you said, Meghna, a carbon tax that really reflects the true cost of these activities, we are not going to make the shifts that are necessary.
Let's go to Larry, who's calling from Middlefield, Connecticut. Larry, you're on the air.
Hi. Just wanted to mention that I work for an electrical company, a national company. And although we pulled out of the climate agreement in Paris, which I disagreed with, and the government itself is spending billions of dollars upgrading for energy efficiency and conservation. I mean, from Fort Greeley, Alaska, down to Tilden Air Force Base in Florida, going solar where it can and upgrading heating, energy, any type they can to save costs and to reduce the carbon footprint. So America is doing stuff and business is doing it. I mean, when we build a new building, we're building it to be energy efficient. So while the Trump administration may have pulled out of the climate agreement, it doesn't mean that industry and the other organizations have pushed it aside.
Yeah. Larry, thank you for your call. And Chris Mooney, let me turn that to you, because I think, you know, Larry makes a very good point about maybe political leadership at the federal level is not there anymore, but businesses and even other aspects of the government have realized the necessity for thinking about climate and how they do what they do. Is that enough?
Well, first, it's true that it's happened. Is it enough is another question I'll get to in a second. But yes, the United States has seen its greenhouse gas emissions decline over the past decade or more. And I think you can make a good argument that while regulations and tax incentives and many things had something to do with that, private sector choices had a great deal to do with that. The leading factors are the fact that many utilities turned off coal plants and started burning natural gas. And also many utilities and also many corporations realized that it was a good investment to start building a lot of wind turbines and a lot of solar. And so our emissions are lower. And this is in large part a private sector decision or set of decisions that's caused this to happen. That said, what the IPCC 1.5C report is saying is that the rate of change that is occurring, and it is occurring, is not fast enough. That alone is not going to get to the 1.5C, get us not to go over the 1.5C limit.
Yeah. Drew Schindel, I mean, maybe we should just get straight to this issue of U.S. political leadership here in the moment. I mean, I know that, of course, this is a global issue by definition. But given the IPCC's latest report, I mean, how much does it matter that the Trump administration has pulled back from the Paris Climate Agreement, that the Trump administration has rolled back what was the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan? I mean, they have put in their own plan in its stead. But are these actions even more significant, given your latest report from yesterday?
I would say that unfortunately they are, because what they're really showing is the scale of the transformation. You know, by 2030, we need to be on a trajectory where we are eliminating the majority of our coal plants. They need to be gone by 2030, and we need to be getting half to two-thirds of our electricity from renewables. That's a huge change compared to we've been making this transition and installing more renewables. But California and Hawaii have targets consistent with that, and we're 48 states short. And we're not getting there.
Can I just underscore something you said? So you said in a dozen years, you would like us to see to get rid of all of our carbon-emitting coal plants and get 60% of our energy from solar and renewables?
By 2030, those are the only scenarios that are consistent with keeping temperatures to 1.5. If you don't do either of those things, it doesn't happen in any of the emission pathways we looked at in the literature.
But Drew Shindell, we are not on that path. I mean, that's a dramatic change in a dozen years. We are nowhere near being on that path.
Can I add something?
Right. Yeah, Chris, go ahead.
That's the path. So renewables, wind and solar, that's one of the areas where the most change has already been made. Of all the sectors that need to change, according to this report, we actually are installing a lot of wind and solar. If you look at transportation, which is at least as big, if not bigger, you see far less rapid change. And so as we put it in our story, I think that vehicles powered by renewable fuels are only about 4% of the global total, and that's not expected to grow fast. That has to grow by leaps and bounds, whereas for global electricity generation, we're over 20% renewable already. It needs to go to something like 60% by 2030, but it's actually grown a lot, whereas with the cars, they're quite far behind the power plants. And then there's a lot of other sectors that we could talk about that are quite far behind.
Let's take another call here. Aaron is calling from Detroit, Michigan. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm going to hurry up and get all of this in. And let me make this clear. I am not pro one world government, but let's be realistic. The things that we're talking about that is required for us to come back from what's going on would take a unified effort. We still have people like our president and other people who are in power claiming that they don't believe that this is real and that that we're the cause of the problem, and so they're not willing to work together. Realistically, as long as capitalism rules the day, there are people on the planet and powers on the planet that believe they are going to be able to survive and capitalize off what may happen, and they're not caring about the planet. They're caring about their own little selfish agendas, and this is almost like a hopeless dilemma we're in because of the way our society functions worldwide.
Aaron, thank you for your call. Drew Shindell, would you like to respond to Aaron?
Well, I think one of the really encouraging things about the report, and I know that there doesn't seem like there were very many, but one is that many, in fact, even most of the actions that we need to take to mitigate climate change provide enormous benefits. And the problem is kind of what we were alluding to before, that these costs are not realized. And so I wouldn't say that this is inherently a problem with capitalism. But for example, the motor vehicle regulations, right? Improving efficiency of motor vehicles is not just good for the planet, but it actually saves the consumer money by having to pay less for fuel over the lifetime of the car. So this is good for public health. This is good for climate. This is good for consumers. The only people it's not good for are a small group of vested interests in the oil companies and the automotive companies that want to maximize near-term profits by rolling these back. But I think
but
we
if
can...
I just may, though, that is a group that wields extraordinary power in terms of how these regulations are written. We've just seen that in the past year with this attempt to roll back CAFE standards.
Exactly. That's exactly the problem. So I think that it's not a problem with the entire system. It's a problem with the way there is so much power given to these small groups of society, these special interests, that can wield an enormous amount of power, especially since Citizens United decision in this country, by donating unlimited amounts of money. So we see places like California taking aggressive action because they put the interests of their citizens ahead of these narrower interests, but we don't yet see that at the national level. And this is the same around the world. You know, Saudi Arabia and Denmark go in opposite directions. It depends on who has the power in the given jurisdiction.
Chris Mooney, we've just got 30 seconds before the break here, but to Aaron's point about this, it'll take a global effort. We do have the Paris Climate Agreement, but has this IPCC report put what should be the new goals even beyond the reach of the most enthusiastic members of the Paris Climate Accord?
Well, they have to decide that, and all the parties to the agreement meet in Poland in December, and I think this is what they're going to be talking about.
Okay, so we're going to come back from a short break here and take some more calls. We're talking about the IPCC's latest report on what the future holds for all of humanity if we continue on the path that we are on now regarding global warming. It's a dire report. We've got links to it and links to lots of reporting on it at onpointradio.org. Chris Mooney is with us, as is Drew Schindel. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's new report about what the future will hold if we continue emitting carbon dioxide into the air the rates that we are now, and how much of a change, civilizational level change, humanity is going to have to undergo in order to get a hold on climate effects or carbon's effect on the climate. So I want to play a little bit of tape here. This is Jim Ski. He's lead author of the IPCC report. He was in South Korea yesterday saying that now that that scientists have sounded the alarm, it's governments that have to decide what to do about the grim forecast.
The message is, we've told you the scientific facts, the evidence, the costs. It is up to the governments now to decide what to do with it.
Okay, so that was Jim Ski just yesterday. So let's roll back the clock a little bit and go back to December 2015. Then candidate Donald Trump, here's what he said about global warming.
So Obama's talking about all of this with the global warming and that, and a lot of it's a hoax. It's a hoax. I mean, it's a money-making industry, okay? It's a hoax.
That's December 2015, then candidate Donald Trump. Of course, Mr. Trump is now president of the United States. Drew Schindel, your author, one of the authors on yesterday's report. I mean, we're 2.5 years out from when Donald Trump said those things about global warming. But in light of what has just been written, what do you think about what the president's attitude was about global warming?
Well, unfortunately, while he's liable to say things well outside of what many in his party would say, that's quite a common view for most of the Republican Party. And it didn't used to be this way. Even a few decades ago, both parties supported environmental protection. And now it has just become, in particular, since the passage of since the Citizens United decision with unlimited campaign finance, without anonymous campaign finance, it's more and more of the Republican Party at least appears to be beholden to the fossil fuel industries. And now they're touting things like creating coal jobs, even though renewables create more jobs than does coal. And even though coal is going away not because of government forces, but because of the other fuels just being cheaper, because of market forces. So there's really this narrative from the Republican Party that's wildly inconsistent with both the facts and the majority of Americans' public opinion or even the marketplace. Hmm.
Chris Mooney, have we heard an official response from the Trump administration, from the State Department, from about a response to the IPCC's report?
Yes, we have statements from the State Department and also from EPA Acting Administrator Andrew Wheeler in our story, actually. And Wheeler, you know, one of our journalists asked him what it would take to keep the world below a dangerous level of climate change. And he didn't identify a specific level, but he pointed out that what the EPA is doing right now would help help to lead to continued innovation in clean coal technologies, and these technologies will be exported to other countries. So there, Wheeler was highlighting something that we also heard from the World Coal Association. They're saying that, you know, because this report clearly targets coal and says that we're going to have to burn a lot less coal and maybe phase it out entirely. And what they're saying is actually, no, we need to create technologies that capture the emissions of coal and bury it below the ground. So that's one of the angles that is being taken on the report.
Yeah, I'm seeing here that a State Department official, as you're reporting, said that, quote, governments do not formally endorse specific findings presented by the authors. And the person went on to say, though, that from 2005 to 2017, U.S. carbon-related emissions declined by 14%, while global energy-related carbon emissions rose by 21% during the same time. So touting U.S. efforts to cut emissions there.
Well, and it's not incorrect. U.S. emissions have gone down. They haven't gone down as much as would be needed for the world to be on track for 1.5 degrees Celsius.
All right, let's take another call here. Bree is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Bree, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. I just had a couple, I guess more like a question slash comment. I think making significant changes manageable for the average person is probably our best hope of actually making change. So kind of like a cute campaign like the straw ban that, you know, sort of blew up on social media and, you know, people really ran with it. Unfortunately, it's not enough to make a dent in the problems that we have in the environment. But is even eating, taking one day a week where we don't consume meat for one day, is that enough to make a change?
Yeah. Well, Bree, thank you. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but thank you for your call because I just want to turn it to Drew Schindel. Individual level efforts, Professor Schindel, as Bree's asking, could they make a difference?
They can. And again, I'd like to highlight that there's some really positive news in this report, too. So we did not, for example, investigate the entire world going to vegetarianism. That seems just so wildly improbable that it's not really worth looking at. But what we looked at was people in primarily in the West who eat too much red meat, according to World Health Organization healthy dietary guidelines, just going back to what's best for them, right? So it's not like we're asking people to make a huge sacrifice. We're asking people to do what they should do anyway for their own body. And that's enough to make a big difference. Livestock has an enormous footprint with the land, the deforestation, the land to feed, grow crops to feed the cattle, etc. And so I think there are things we can do, more active transport, biking and walking, more use of mass transit. Those are active transport is also good for your health, you know. But there are limits too. We cannot all go buy electric cars unless there is charging infrastructure. And currently, at least in the state where I live, we have a special tax on electric cars rather than the government trying to encourage us to adopt them. So there are ways that we can facilitate people making choices. We can buy more efficient air conditioners only if they're available in the stores. And they're not available unless companies are pushed to make these kind of products. So it's an interplay between individual choice and the system that determines the range of options that are available.
Let's go to Kevin, who's calling from Abbeville, Louisiana. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Kevin. What's your thought?
How you doing? I just had a comment to make. You know, I work in the oil industry, and there's a lot of infrastructure that's already in place, like in the Gulf of Mexico, per se. There's 2,000 platforms out there that has jackets in the water. might be a little less than that, but at least 1,000, where wind farms could be adapted to those jackets easily. I mean, but naturally the infrastructure would have to be built to, you know, the power generation to get it to the beach. But that's something that could be done. Also, when an oil company does exploration on a certain area, they have to mitigate somewhere else. It doesn't matter if they dropped a drop of oil there or not. If they kept it clean the whole time, they have to spend money to mitigate another area that needs mitigating or needs restoration.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a balance, you know, and they do spend money to the good. I guess some people would call it to the good because, you know, mining industry, some people it's bad.
Yeah.
But we use it. We need it. You know, that's my comment. That's
well, Kevin, thank you actually so much for your call. Chris Mooney, do you want to respond to him? I mean, that first part, Kevin's indicating that, I mean, he's out there working in the Gulf oil field saying that there is infrastructure in place if we wanted to expand wind generation.
Well, there's actually a close relationship between offshore oil and offshore wind. I mean, you find a company like Statoil, which is a major oil producer, now going very strong into the offshore wind industry and the sort of the deep offshore wind industry, which is where you need really, really powerful infrastructure and where some of the most powerful wind can be harnessed. And if you can get it to shore, then you can get yourself quite a lot of renewable energy. I think it goes to show that there is a corporate transition that's happening right now. Again, it's not at the pace that the 1.5C report calls for.
Right.
But there is all kinds of action happening. It's just the question is, can it somehow be marshaled across the globe in policies that are unified by all the governments? And that's really what this report is asking for.
I want to get one more call in here. Dave is calling from Stowe, Massachusetts. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks very much for taking my call. And I want to say you're doing an excellent job as the host. I see this as a great opportunity. And I don't want to minimize how difficult it's going to be, because technologically it's a tough, difficult thing. But your guests have already spelled out in terms of, you know, if we eat less meat, that's going to help the environment and help our health. And one other very quick cost, we need to make the economy recognize, you know, damages 100 years out, not just 10 years out. That's
yeah.
a problem. That's something we can solve. And the other thing I wanted to say, which is a really important point, I work in energy conservation, and your guests obviously know this, but every time I hear this discussed, nobody brings up the fastest, easiest, and least environmentally difficult with the best payback way of reducing energy use, and that's through conservation and either you know, higher efficiency or doing without or planning better.
Yeah.
I use about a quarter to a fifth of the energy of the average American household, and I work out of my house. The computer's on all the time, and I've got all the toys.
Dave, I'm just going to take it back from you there because we're running out of time, but thank you for your call. Drew Schindel, just last thought goes to you on this, because I think the thing that I find most compelling about what Dave said is that we are still, no matter how many reports we have, we fundamentally have this disconnect between many governments and short-term focus on the short-term impacts versus the reality that there are long-term issues that we need to be planning for now, right? There's just this disconnect here. How do we get past that?
Well, there really is. You know, that's the EPA administrator's comment that we need to do research on clean coal. You know, that fails to recognize that we have to get rid of coal within the next decade. That we're not talking about research 30 years down the line. We need to act immediately. And we need people to realize that, yes, their electricity bill might go up $10 a month, but this might prevent $100 a month in taxes to pay for disaster relief and $200 to pay for increased health care costs and in their insurance premiums. I mean, there's an enormous amount of other impacts of all these things. If we take these kind of energy efficiency measures we just heard about, they pay for themselves.
Yeah.
There are a lot of good things we can do, reap enormous benefits, but, you know, we're really not recognizing the urgency or aligning our systems to really reap the benefits that are outlined very clearly in the report.
Well, in just a second, we're going to talk to someone who recognizes the urgency very keenly. But Drew Schindel, professor of climate sciences at Duke University and one of the authors on yesterday's IPCC report, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Chris Mooney covers climate change and energy for the environment, energy and the environment at the Washington Post. We've got links to Chris's reporting at onpointradio.org. Chris, thank you so much as well.
It's been great to be here.
You know, so throughout this hour, we've been talking about this disconnect between the urgency of the action that we need to take now globally versus that some of these effects might be 10 or 15 or 20 years out in the future. But guess what? That future belongs to young people. And there are 21 young Americans who have decided that they are going to sue. They are suing the federal government and in what they see as the government's lack of action on climate change. And their suit is headed to trial later this month. They're arguing that they have a right to a safe climate. To find out more, let's talk to one of those folks. Victoria Barnett joins us. She's one of the 21 young plaintiffs in the case of Juliana versus the United States. She's a 19-year-old student at the University of Wisconsin and joins us today from Madison. Victoria, welcome to On Point.
Hey, hi.
So what's your argument here? Why are you saying that the U.S. government should be sued for its lack of action on climate change?
So us 21 young people are suing the U.S. federal government for taking direct action to put our future disproportionately at risk by subsidizing fossil fuels, perpetuating the global climate crisis.
Now, you're making the argument that your constitutional right to due process has been violated. How?
Yes, we're arguing that our constitutional right to life, liberty, and property has been violated through the disasters that climate change can bring. And we feel that young people should be able to bring this information and bring this knowledge to the court and really put it in front of them, because fact of the matter is we have a vested interest in how climate change impacts humanity, because we're going to be here a little longer than some of the people making the decision-making processes right now.
Yeah. And so what do you, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen with the court case, but what do you hope for? Say for a second, hypothetically, that the federal judges find in your favor. What outcome would you like?
Well, what we'd really hope for is for the U.S. federal government to institute a climate recovery plan, so a plan that could bring U.S. carbon emissions down to a safe and sustainable level for continued thriving in our environment, and especially for young people to continue to thrive in our environment, and for future generations after us to continue to be able to do the same. Hmm.
But, you know, I mean, right now the EPA does have regulations on emissions. There are all sorts of rules in various parts of the government regarding how much carbon is put into the air. I mean, what do you say to people who say you just can't even make the argument that the government has knowingly endangered you?
I would say that, you know, looking at the IPCC report, looking at what's happening in the world right now with natural disasters, with climate change, with environmental degradation, it's clear that humans are taking action that's putting our Earth at risk. And the U.S. federal government has some of the highest carbon emissions in the world and is contributing so much to this issue that is disproportionately impacting people all over the world. It's an issue of justice. We have some of the highest emissions in the world, and some of the countries with some of the lowest emissions in the world are being impacted in the least way. Fact is, our carbon emissions need to be brought down, and they're not being brought down at all of a quick enough level for young people like me to feel confident in the future that we get to live in, the future that we get to take control of.
Well, Victoria Barnett is one of 21 plaintiffs in the case of Juliana versus the United States. That case is scheduled to begin later this month in federal court in Oregon. And Victoria is a 19-year-old student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison studying political science and environmental studies. Victoria, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And folks, go to onpointradio.org and let us know what you think about the IPCC's latest report and what you see in our climate future. Again, onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.